This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM, WUOT Knoxville. 6 minutes past 1 o'clock, and I'm your host, Matt Schaefer-Powell. Ulysses S. Grant was called as brainless as his saddle. Abraham Lincoln was portrayed as a horrid-looking wretch. And in the presidential election of 1848, Democrat Lewis Cass was described as pot-bellied, mutton-headed, and cucumber-souled. So, no, vindictive language in a presidential campaign is nothing new, but there is something different about the way Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton are sparring this year. How is Trump using political correctness, or the lack thereof, to attract voters? And how is Twitter changing the way Hillary Clinton approaches the campaign? University of Tennessee professor Stuart Brotman specializes in the way candidates relate to the electorate, and we're privileged to have him here as a guest on Dialogue today. So, Stuart Brotman, welcome to Dialogue.
Thanks, Matt. Pleasure to be here.
First, I should point out that a lot of the so-called innovation in this campaign seems to be coming from the Trump camp. First of all, would you agree that that's the case?
I would agree absolutely with that. I also should point out that I'm a nonpartisan in this particular campaign. I'm not supporting either of the candidates. I've not contributed financially. And so I have the luxury of being able to step back and look at both races and both candidates, particularly how they communicate using both technology and interpersonally, and be able to bring that into the classroom and into the research community and now today out to the world.
Well, and one other reason I wanted to bring that up is because so much of it is coming from the Trump camp, it may appear to some may perceive it as Trump bashing. It's not. It's just part of the conversation. And I think anybody who's looking at this campaign objectively would say, oh, absolutely, that's where a lot of this change is coming from.
I think that's right. I think also if we did a poll, most people would say that this is the most unusual campaign that they have ever either participated in or remembered. And so clearly we're living history as we speak.
You know, I just referred to the fact that name-calling and hyperbole are nothing new in a presidential campaign. So what is different about this election? Why would people respond that way?
I think it's the mixture of media and message. But clearly this is the campaign where social media is in full flower. Even the last campaign and certainly the 2008 campaign, which raised a lot of money and began to use email and other sort of online techniques. Now, clearly, Twitter, Tumblr, LinkedIn, Google Play, Facebook are in full flower. And there's a full array of social media tools. And I think the candidates are really using those tools almost as a palette to be able to get their messages out and to shape their messages to those particular media.
How are we seeing that? I mean, obviously, we're seeing it in that people are following their Twitter accounts. But how in other ways are we seeing much more of a reliance on social media?
Well, I think if you look at the Trump campaign literally has built a platform on Twitter so that much of the reporting that's done is done by following the Trump Twitter feed to see what Trump is saying, to then report what the response to his Twitter outrage is, and then to go back and forth. So many reporters, in fact, most major reporters for media outlets today, they're helping to shape their stories by following a Twitter feed. And the two main Twitter feeds that they're looking at are the ones from the Trump campaign and the Clinton campaign.
And it would seem almost silly to say this, but the campaigns know that.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, they have social media teams. One of the big differences, I think, between the Clinton and the Trump campaigns is that the Trump campaign is basically organized around his inner circle. And there are really just a few people that Trump trusts and is around all the time. And typically what he will do is just be in meetings or with them and start saying, this is what I want on Twitter. Someone will then put it out and tweet it. Trump has also said that in the evening hours, he actually takes control of his smartphone and begins to take out his thumbs and have his own tweets go out directly. So there are some differences between the tweets from Trump that you see during the day, which are essentially transcribed tweets that are given through his oral direction, and the ones that he actually puts in directly himself. And often those tend to be a little more direct and a little more outrageous.
And we're not seeing that at all from Hillary Clinton's camp. Are we to assume that she's not really tweeting anything here or...
Well, what's interesting is that she has developed a signature, and so when she herself is tweeting, she will initial that as H, and that's meant to signal that she herself has tweeted it. And that's been a very rare occurrence, but there have been a series of tweets which she directly communicated. But the rest are done by a team and probably not at the level of intimacy with the candidate that the Trump campaign has.
You know, it's interesting thinking about this idea of the inner circle when you talk about the inner circle. And as a fan of West Wing and to those other fans of West Wing who will know what I'm talking about, we kind of have this image that the candidate is surrounded by the Joshes and the Tobys and the CJ Craigs where the candidate may have input. They're also receiving a lot of advice on how to go about their campaigns. Now, obviously, that's a fictional TV show, but from all accounts, it's fairly similar to what happens as has happened in a typical presidential campaign.
Yeah, I think the difference here is that the Trump organization is running the Trump campaign, and that Donald Trump sits in the same office where he runs the Trump organization and runs the Trump campaign, and the people who are around him, by and large, are the people involved in the Trump organization.
And when you say Trump organization, you're talking about his business.
Absolutely.
His business interests.
Absolutely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that's in Trump Tower in New York. When you contrast that with Hillary Clinton, Hillary Clinton has a campaign office in Brooklyn, New York, which has about 700 staff people. So if you can imagine a large facility, basically an open facility with hundreds of people sitting there in front of computers and monitors versus the Trump organization where everyone is basically within 50 feet of each other, probably 30 or 40 people. And so the scale is massively different, and anyone can walk into Trump's office and talk to him directly, or he can call someone in. That's not the case with the Clinton campaign.
Well, you know, this is kind of interesting. I'm going to ask you to speculate, and it won't be the last time I do that, I'm sure, during the coming hour. But Trump is bringing a very specific mode of operation to this because he is a businessman. If we are indeed changing the model of how campaigns are run, is it going to be appropriate or even advantageous to a future candidate to work from that same business-oriented model if he or she is not necessarily a businessman?
Well, remember, in 2012, we had a Republican candidate who also was a businessman, Mitt Romney.
Yeah,
but
right.
He was a very different businessman because he came from the private equity world and the investment world. Trump is unusual because he comes from the world of brands and the world of retail brands. And so he is in the business of essentially building products or offering products, and in some case services, which are branded to retail customers. And so that's the business acumen. He has a very specific business knowledge and expertise that he's brought to the campaign. It will be interesting to see whether other candidates with a business background have that same level of brand consciousness and identity. I don't think there are very many in this country who would then come forward, regardless of who wins this campaign.
Is it to get back to that model of how Trump is using his organization to develop campaign strategy? Do we get the impression that he is actually dictating to the people around the table, this is what we're doing, as opposed to the model where you have the advisors who are saying, no, this is what you should do?
Well, I don't have any inner knowledge, but what's interesting about Trump is I think he's really exposed a lot of his campaign operation to the public. Clearly, he's had a series of campaign managers and other people who have been hired and fired throughout. And I think the general perception is they are basically employees of the Trump campaign and the Trump organization. And the way that they work is that if Trump disagrees with them or doesn't think they're doing a very good job, then essentially they will be replaced and someone else will step in. So I think it's very much of a top-down operation. And even though right now there is CEO Steve Bannon who's been brought in, I think Trump truly is the chairman of the board.
When we're talking about social media, I'm wondering if the heavy use of social media is causing us as voters to lose out on some of the nuance, some of the complexity of a campaign. Because, I mean, if we use Twitter as an example, you have 140 characters. You're not going to be able to insert your entire domestic policy strategy in 140 characters.
It is, but for the reason I said before, which is that most of our reporting is still done through mass media. Most of our news is still through either newspapers or radio or television. But the reporters themselves are the ones who are following social media, and they are shaping their stories around what they read on Twitter and Tumblr and other social media. And so a lot of the messages that are going out are not necessarily messages that are directed to the public. They're directed to reporters who will then report on what that message was and hopefully create some controversy around that message. And that's known as the news cycle. So typically that might take a day or 2 days between the message going out and some response and some counter response. And then we wake up again like Groundhog Day, and there's another news cycle, another news cycle, and another news cycle. And then November 8th is Election Day.
Is that setting a dangerous precedent in terms of these what we might consider the mainstream reporters relying so heavily on Twitter for their information about the candidates?
Well, I think there will be a good deal of self-reflection. Again, it doesn't really matter who wins at the end. By media outlets, in terms of how the race was covered, certainly we have a premium now on the so-called horse race. Everyone is always saying, here are today's polls. As you know, from a general perspective, polls are relatively meaningless, particularly at this point in time. And as you know, they vary across the lot. And we have this incredible horse race that yesterday so-and-so was up a point or down a point. At the end of the day, of course, our elections aren't controlled by polls, and they're not even controlled by popular votes. They're controlled by the Electoral College. And so the most important data that people should be following is essentially who will be able to aggregate 270 electoral votes, which is what it takes to elect the president.
You know, for the last half century or so, debates and campaign ads were really some of the most important, primary, effective ways for candidates to get their messages across. Is that changing?
It is. Let me just give you a little history here. We only have had presidential debates. We had them in 1960 because there was a special act of Congress which allowed Richard Nixon and John F. Kennedy to debate. In 1972, that act was not in effect. And in 1976, there was a ruling by the Federal Communications Commission that essentially said that debates would be allowed if they would be staged by outside parties and covered by news organizations as news events. And for that reason, there was a debate between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter in the 1976 race. What's happened in subsequent years is that that standard has been loosened, and now we've seen a lot of the candidates really take control of the debates in a way that they weren't 10 or 15 years ago, when the debates were essentially staged by outside organizations. The candidates were invited to come in and participate, but they really had no say in how the debate was organized. What we have now is a Presidential Debate Commission, which is a bipartisan organization that essentially sets the rules for the presidential debates. And we have had some controversy, probably more controversy in this campaign than in previous campaigns, because of the rules. Typically, those rules are set well in advance of even knowing who the candidates are. They're set maybe 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump has been very active, particularly on Twitter, in terms of saying that he may not participate in the debates because he doesn't like the rules. He needs to understand who the moderators are. He needs to make sure they're not biased, and on and on. This has been historic because the debate rules have never been challenged. These have been rules, again, that have been formulated by a bipartisan group, a commission which has been set up and which has done this historically since 1976. At this point, though, it looks like both candidates will participate. The first presidential debate is on September 26th, and we have three presidential debates and one vice presidential debate, which is traditionally what's been done.
Well, maybe this is too soon to ask this question then, considering that we haven't gotten an opportunity to see Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump debate. But do you think in the voters' minds these debates are as relevant as they once would have been?
I think to some extent they are the WrestleMania of politics. I think everyone is looking at these, whatever sports metaphor you want to use, whether you call it the Super Bowl or the World Series or WrestleMania. But I think everyone is looking at the debates as this great sport between the two gladiators coming into the arena and perhaps changing the election. And that may turn out to be the case, but it also may raise expectations a little too high. I think by and large, campaigns tend to get set pretty early, particularly post-convention. And now that we're post-Labor Day, it would be very difficult for a candidate to totally change the perception among voters on the basis of debate performance. I mean, if you go back historically, we could take 1984 as an example. So in 1984, Ronald Reagan, who was then the incumbent, had a terrible first debate performance and could not remember things, was not terribly articulate. And, you know, he came around the second and third debate, and the way he came around typically was to go back to his speechwriters and scriptwriters and get some good one-liners, the most classic of which was when he was asked about his age, which was one of the suggestions of why he wasn't performing well, because he was older. He basically turned that around and essentially said that he would not use age and experience as a campaign issue against Walter Mondale. And that became the line that was repeated over and over. I think if there was social media today, that would have been the line that is tweeted out in 140 characters.
Well, you just brought up a couple of different things that I want to make sure that I follow up on, one of which is professional wrestling. So we're going to get to that after we take a quick break here on Dialogue. Our guest today is University of Tennessee Communication and Information Professor Stuart Brotman. And we're talking about how this year's presidential candidates are forcing fundamental changes in the way they speak with the voters. If you want to participate in the conversation, you can tweet us at WUOTFM, send us a Facebook message, or fill out that cool little box on our homepage. That's WUOT.org. And as always, you can call us. Phone lines are open, 974-5050. That's 974-5050, and this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell, and joined today by Stuart Brotman, a political communications professor at the University of Tennessee and a veteran of four presidential administrations.
That's right.
We're talking about how presidential campaigns are changing before our eyes. If you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter or on Facebook. And if you go to our webpage, there's a neat little question box you can fill out, and we will do our best to get your question to our guest. And of course, you can always just call us. Phone lines are open right now, 974-5050, 974-5050. And just before the break, you mentioned wrestling. And I wanted to use this as an opportunity. You and I, before the show, were talking, and you said there is an element to this campaign that is reminiscent of professional wrestling.
I think so. I think many people may not be aware that Donald Trump has a long history with the WWE, which is the Worldwide Wrestling Organization, Vince McMahon, and has actually participated in some of their programs. If you wanted to Google, you will see a wonderful piece of video where Donald Trump essentially beats up a wrestler and shaves their head during a match.
Let's hope we don't see that on the debate.
And it looks very much like what you would see in another type of wrestling program. He also is an investor in UFC, which is the Ultimate Fighting Champions. And so he understands the dynamics of professional wrestling and UFC, which is to obviously make it dramatic, to have good guys and bad guys, to have language which is very colorful and provocative, to have crowd response which is very loud and in some cases angry. So
when we hear the crooked Hillary, for instance, in one of his speeches, the response is a resounding boo from the crowd.
Yes, absolutely. And we saw that not just in the general election, but we certainly saw that in the primary campaign, where virtually every Trump opponent was given a nickname by Trump in a way that if Trump were a wrestler, he would have given similar nicknames to them in terms of promoting them for a future WrestleMania match.
Let's go to the phones right now. Charles is calling from Maryville, Tennessee. Charles, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
You bet.
My question quickly is, we've been talking, or you all have been talking a lot about the advent of social media or its prevalence in this campaign. And I'm wondering if we did not see the sort of the beginning of it or the roots of it during the Obama campaign in 2008.
Yeah, great question. Thank you, Charles.
Well, what we did, as you know, the Obama campaign in 2008 began to use social media to raise money. And that was very dramatic because we had a whole new way to raise money. Before the Obama became campaign in 2008, all of the federal campaigns for president were federally funded. There was something on your tax return with a checkoff box where you can voluntarily contribute money, and all of that money is thrown into a pool, and then candidates typically would access the pool. The problem for the candidates is that it had a cap. So if you were going to take federal money, you could only take a certain amount of money. You could not take outside money. What we've had since is certainly the Citizen United case, which essentially has flowered in terms of super PACs, which now have unlimited money that they can give. They can't give it to a campaign. They have to be separate, but they could certainly support a campaign through their outside work. We saw in the Sanders campaign this year for the Democratic nomination that he used social media again in the Obama model of using it to raise a lot of small donors. And in fact, he broke the Obama record. He had more small donors giving $10, $15, $25 to his campaign than any candidate in the history of the United States. So I think the real genius of the Obama campaign was the tying of social media to fundraising. I think what's different in this campaign is the tying of social media to messaging.
You know, you talked earlier about how reporters are quite often among the most vociferous watchers of these Twitter accounts. And it's interesting to me, if you consider what is to be assumed the Trump voters who may be a little bit older and may not be as inclined to follow social media, it makes me think that Trump isn't using the social media specifically to reach his followers, but sort of going through the media that then goes to his traditional base.
That's right. If we were playing basketball, we would call this a bank shot. So what Trump is doing essentially is getting messages out, not directly, but getting them indirectly. So he reaches people on Twitter, not by getting the messages out to them directly, although obviously he does have millions of followers, but he's getting those messages out primarily by having intermediaries, reporters, report on the messages. We see the same thing now in some of his speeches. In the past week or so, he's been targeting speeches for African-American audiences, mm-hmm. although I think all polling and virtually everyone would agree he has a very, very small chance of gaining a substantial portion of African-American voters. Right now, he's somewhere between 2% and 4%. So what he is doing essentially is going to the African-American community to send a message to the suburban community, the people who essentially may think that Trump might not be racially neutral or may have racial animus towards African-Americans. By going into those communities and making those speeches, the intent is to make other people feel more comfortable that Trump would be a reasonable president.
So these are people maybe who are not quite as passionate about the Trump campaign, who maybe even are on the fence about it. This is to sort of alleviate some of their fears about some of the more extreme things that have come out from his campaign.
Yes, this is what's called the independent voter, and obviously those are the voters that tend to swing elections. So what's different in this campaign also right now is that there are probably fewer undecideds at this point in the election than virtually any recent campaign. So right now, all the polling tells us that 90% of the voters have already made up their mind. They're either voting for Trump or Clinton. Obviously, we also have two third-party and a fourth-party candidate. Right. We have Jill Stein for the Green Party. We have Gary Johnson for the Libertarian Party. And they potentially could take about 10 to 12% of the vote. But if you add up all those numbers, voters have already decided, and so there's a very, very small group, about 10% of the voting population, which still is out there to make up their mind. I think the other interesting aspect is the development of early voting. So the polls basically are opening within a matter of weeks. A number of states, I think Minnesota is the first, mm-hmm. which allow voting 30, in some cases more than 30 days before. These are votes that can be done through ballots, either showing up at the poll, in some cases electronic. And apparently a third of the American public will be voting before November 8th. We still think of Election Day as the time where we all go to the polls, but this is the election where a third of us will have already voted.
Will social media be able to use that? Will the candidates be able to use that to their advantage with social media, or will that really not be a factor?
Well, we're not really going to know the results, but clearly if you wanted to drive certain demographics to the polls, for example, younger people, if you're in college, you may not necessarily say that I'm going to go to the poll on November 8th to vote. But you may, if you had the opportunity to vote early, you might say, gee, I have nothing to do Tuesday afternoon. I'll go down and vote and have that opportunity. So if you wanted to use social media to target particular groups, particularly younger groups, to make sure they vote, one of the areas that's still unknown is how many younger people will come out to the polls. And so social media can help drive some of that traffic to election polls, and particularly before November 8th.
This is a question coming from our webpage. Again, if you go to WUOT.org, right at the top of the webpage, there is a little box, and you can submit your question that way. This question it reads like this. Trump flouts rules of decorum and appropriateness. How should Clinton react to that behavior in the debates?
Well, again, I'm not a debate strategist, but I think clearly what you will see are two entirely different approaches. I think Clinton, which is consistent with the way she's been running her campaign, is to try to focus on traditional areas of policy, whether that's domestic policy, which would be the economy, healthcare, education, or foreign policy, which would be things like trade, terrorism, international relations, nuclear power. These are the staples, the meat and potatoes of typical campaigns. Trump really has not focused very much on those areas. He's really focused more on what would be known as the gestalt, the overall environment, the idea that you really need a leader to come in and take charge. And particularly with his view of the world, things are really, really bad now. And so that really puts a premium on having the type of leadership that he's trying to offer.
In a recent column you wrote for The Hill, you say, quote, It now is politically correct to say that too many people are easily offended these days over language itself. What do you mean by that?
Well, what's been interesting, Trump has built a lot of his campaign around being politically incorrect, saying things that people were thinking but they couldn't say because they didn't think it was polite or part of civil discourse. And I think Trump has really made that a virtue. He's made it such a virtue now that it looks like more people do that than they do what used to be called civic discourse, which is to say, you know, there are certain things we shouldn't say or don't want to say, or we want to couch in different language. And so those people now are in the minority as opposed to the majority. And so when you look at political correctness, which typically would favor the majority of people now seem to be politically incorrect. And so if you
were proud of it
and proud of and proud of it. Exactly. So we've sort of had a total reversal of those two concepts.
Do you think it's actually a strategy of the Trump camp, or do you think it's just a reflection of who Donald Trump is as far as this political correctness?
I think a combination of both. I think Trump is an extraordinary strategist, and I think whatever you think about his business record, he has built a substantially a good business record in a number of areas, particularly in the areas of hotels and golf courses and resorts. I mean, that really is his core strength. And some of the other areas like steaks and wine and airplanes have not been as good. But clearly, he does have a very organized strategy in terms of how he wants to project himself. And he also wants to project himself in a way that he thinks is authentic and that comes across as authentic. So it's the combination of perception, reality, and experience that I think Trump is bringing to the table.
Do you think it's changing the national conversation? In other words, do you think it's changing how Americans are speaking amongst themselves?
I think so. I think there is probably greater anger that was not perceived, certainly in the last election and previous elections. And so I think there is a lot of dissension. I think you find now couples who are arguing at the dinner table. There's a a wife or a husband who favors Trump and a wife or a husband who favors Clinton. And we've seen a number of people now go into therapy and consult outside people because they can't resolve those differences. And so that's just anecdotal, but I've seen a number of situations where probably the leisurely discussions that you remembered are no longer as leisurely.
If Donald Trump is an example of somebody, a candidate challenging the status quo, what are some examples of other candidates in the past who have really kind of made that the focal point of their campaign?
Well, a couple come to mind. One would be Pat Buchanan, and Pat Buchanan ran for president. He wasn't nominated by the Republicans, but he was a pretty serious challenger in 1992. And remember, in 1992, we had an incumbent president, George H.W. Bush. So he was challenging the incumbent, and he beat Bush in the first primary, the New Hampshire primary, with some of the same techniques that Trump had, certainly not social media, but much of raising anger, the language, sort of the political slant of the voters and trying to capture that anger. So that would be one example. The other one that comes to mind is Ross Perot. And Ross Perot, as you remember, was an independent candidate and had some similarities to Trump.
He was a very successful businessman.
He's a successful billionaire businessman. He basically had been in the public eye for many years, and so he wasn't someone who basically walked on the stage and people said, "Who is Ross Perot?" And he wound up getting about 12% of the vote. So those two candidates, I think, were the candidates most people thought Trump would wind up being. He would wind up being an interesting but relatively minor candidate, either someone who would not be nominated by a major party or someone who would go out and mount an independent campaign like Ross Perot.
Can we look at Ross Perot's campaign as, I guess I'm choosing my word carefully here, but as a failure? Yes, he got 12% of the popular vote, but he really was stomped in the electoral vote.
I think that's right. And I think for most listeners, they may be scratching their heads now or Googling who is Ross Perot, because many people don't even remember that he was a candidate or a substantial candidate. In fact, he actually participated in the presidential debates because he had enough polling numbers to justify him being in the debate. We still may have that in this election because there's a threshold of 15% polling. If you poll nationally at 15% or above, the rules of the Presidential Debate Commission is that you're allowed into a presidential debate. Right now, Gary Johnson, who's a Libertarian candidate, is polling somewhere between 10 and 12%. So it is quite possible that perhaps in October he will be up to 15%, which means that he may wind up being in the third or perhaps second and third presidential debates.
But when we look back on like a Ross Perot or even a Pat Buchanan campaign, do we say, well, that was interesting, but that didn't work. Let's not do that again.
Well, clearly this is working. Trump is working. And I think, again, when you look back at the Trump announcement, when he rode down the elevator in Trump Tower, it was treated similar to a Buchanan or a Perot campaign. Basically had humorous elements. It wasn't a serious candidacy. But by vanquishing 16 other candidates in the Republican primaries, the proof is in the pudding. And when you get that many primary voters and ultimately get the nomination, then you're an entirely different ballgame.
I see that Terry from Brewstertown is holding. And Terry, hang in there a little bit longer. We're going to take a quick break here on Dialogue, and we will take your call when we get back. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. Our guest today is University of Tennessee Communication and Information Professor Stuart Brotman. We're talking about how this year's presidential candidates are forcing fundamental changes in the way candidates speak with the voters. If you want to participate, you can tweet us at WUOTFM. We're on Facebook. You can fill out that box on our homepage, WUOT.org. And of course, just like Terry from Brewstertown, you can call us at 974-5050. That's 974-5050. And this is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. This is Dialogue on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Matt Schaefer-Powell and joined today by Stuart Brotman, a political communications professor at the University of Tennessee and a veteran of four presidential administrations. We're talking about how presidential campaigns are changing before our eyes. And if you have questions or comments, you can catch us on Twitter or on Facebook. And if you go to our webpage, there's that box there toward the top of the page. You can fill that out and we will do our best to get your question to our guests. And, of course, you can just call us. That's what Terry from Brewstertown did. And, Terry, welcome to Dialogue. Thank you very much for holding.
Thank you, Matt. Dr. Brotman, given the reduction to fake wrestling and other entertainment trash talk of this presidential campaign, and the extreme monopoly that the Republican and Democrat parties have on even allowing someone to put their hat in the ring for the presidential campaign, do you think there will be ways that the voters may acquire much beyond that monopoly in the future? And the other question is about political correctness. If everybody that argues against political correctness would take the worst, most offensive, most irritating name that anybody could call them, has ever called them, and put a big sign on their chest so that everybody can refer to them that way, then I think they'll change their mind about something that is the first rule of all 10 of the world's major religions and philosophies, which is treat others like you want to be treated.
All right, Terry, thank you so much for the call.
Well, let me at least address the first issue, which is how other candidates can be involved. I think what's interesting is previously we've had third-party candidates. What's interesting about this campaign is we have third- and fourth-party candidates. And I think social media actually is a positive element of having other candidates come into the race. They may not fit into the construct of an existing presidential debate structure. But again, if they get 15% of the vote or 15% in national polling, they are allowed into the debates. And in order to get that 15%, you could use social media to essentially get greater attention, get more people to essentially answer polls, get more reporting about you. I think most people are aware now of these other two candidates, Gary Johnson and Jill Stein. And they also have qualified to be on the ballot in all 50 states. And so not only are they announced candidates, but they are candidates that people will be able to go and vote for either on November 8th or through early voting.
You know, when we decry social media in general, not specifically to a campaign, one of the things that we bring up is that because so often it's anonymous, people can just be very mean-spirited and say whatever they want. And I'm wondering if the nature of social media and that aspect of social media is fueling, to a certain extent, some of these attitudes about political correctness.
It may be. I wanted to mention, because we have a tremendous, unique resource at the University of Tennessee, which we're going to be using, I'm going to be using, and my students are going to be using. We have something called the Adam Brown Social Media Center. We're the only university in the country that has essentially this analytic platform that can listen to all social media 24/7 and begin to understand, categorize what people are saying either by issue, geography, language, you think of any way that you would want to analyze social media, we can do it. And we are unique across any university in the United States because we have that capability. And so we're going to be doing that and listening very closely and reporting back to the press and others in terms of what people are saying. And I think that's been a tremendous aspect of this campaign and a unique aspect of what we have here at Tennessee.
Let's go to another question that we have from the website. Julian Assange has indicated that he may release documents in October that would be damaging to Clinton. How might this change the race?
Well, what's interesting is we've always had this phenomenon of the October surprise, this notion that in the last few weeks of the campaign, there was going to be one great dramatic development that somehow would change the race. I think social media, to some extent, has taken the air out of the balloon of the October surprise. Right now, in fact, we have people sort of forecasting what the October surprise might be. And so I think by the time the October surprise comes, if it does, it will not quite be as surprising as the other ones in the past.
And so social media is good at letting the cat out of the bag.
I think so. I think so. And so I think the days of the October surprise are probably waning at this point.
What's a flashpoint?
A flashpoint is where something happens in a campaign which essentially changes the dynamic of the campaign. One obvious illustration at the Democratic convention when the Khan family, the mother and father of the Gold Star soldier who was killed, spoke, and when the father dramatically took a copy of the Constitution out of his pocket, that became a flashpoint in the campaign, and it obviously was reported around the world, but more critically became something where the campaigns began to talk about it and use that as a way to illustrate where they stood on particular issues, particularly because the Trump campaign has been very active in terms of talking about a ban on Muslims or other people coming into the United States. There have been things about the military that have been talked about in the campaign. So the flashpoint of the Khan family, in particular the father, having that address, holding up the Constitution, is a great illustration.
But flashpoints themselves are not new in this campaign. And actually, what I'm thinking of specifically is the vice presidential debate between Lloyd Bentsen and Dan Quayle, when Lloyd Bentsen said, "You are no Jack. I knew Jack Kennedy. You are no Jack Kennedy." That's a flashpoint?
Oh, absolutely. I think the difference now is that there are many more flashpoints, and obviously you can go viral, so to speak. You can get these flashpoints out immediately. Again, reporters are looking for these flashpoints because they want to write stories about them. So essentially there's a much bigger echo chamber for flashpoints to be communicated through.
And you think the campaigns are going out of their way to create these flashpoints?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, it goes back to the news cycle. Basically, if you're in a campaign, what you want to do is control the news cycle, which typically is a 24 to 36 hour period. And the way you feed a news cycle and try to control it is to be able to take advantage of these flashpoints.
I think we have a chance to take one more phone call, and let's go to Marion, who's calling from Oak Ridge. Marion, welcome to Dialogue.
Hello, and thank you. My question is exactly what you just started talking about. I wonder how the professor feels about my theory, which is that it's the reporters who have utterly changed campaigning, not the candidates, because of what the reporters choose to cover, because it's easy and keeps ratings up.
Excellent question.
Those sound bites.
Thank you very much for the call, Marion.
Well, remember, we also have a new generation of reporters. We have reporters who are digital natives. These are younger reporters who have grown up using technology. They communicate with the technology. They're very comfortable with social media. So these are the tools that they are using, and they're comfortable using that in the way that older reporters would use a typewriter or even a stenography pad. So I think the nature of journalism has changed, and the new reporters coming into it basically are relying on the tools that are here now as opposed to the tools that were here many years ago. Back to reporting, I think the reporting is still reporting, which is that reporters are still looking to cover stories. And if the stories happen to be generated through social media as opposed to a candidate having a press conference, they'll do that. I think one of the disconnects is now there's some controversy about candidates not holding press conferences. I think the days of candidate press conferences also are waning because on a day-to-day basis, we hear so much from candidates through media, through social media, that the idea of standing up for 60 or 90 minutes and answering a set list of questions seems to be a little antiquated.
Well, the last thing I want to do is come off as an apologist for sloppy reporting. But I would say that the reporters covering the 2016 campaign have fewer resources, there are fewer personnel, especially in newspaper reporting, than there was, say, 20 years ago.
I think that's absolutely right. Again, many journalism organizations send a single reporter out now who essentially has to produce that piece, that has to, in some cases, record it, be the videographer, be the on-air reporter. So I think the resources of news organizations also have essentially pressed the way that journalists have to do their job.
I want to talk for a moment about polling. You referred to polling a little bit earlier, and there are now so many polls. I think for the average voter, sometimes it's difficult to know which is reliable and which isn't. And I'm wondering how much of that saturation of polling data is part of presidential campaign strategy.
Oh, it's an essential part of campaign strategy. What's useful now is that there are averages of polls, and there are polls of polls, mm-hmm. which means that they take all the polls together and average them out and give you, a more moderated view of that. But again, at the end of the day, the most important polls to look at are the polls that are tied into Electoral College votes. And so those would be state-by-state polling. So if you have any interest in looking at opinion data, the best data to look at right now are state-by-state polls.
I have to think, too, when we're talking about polling, that technology is changing how we can interpret polling data as well. Let me use this example. A polling company that may rely on landlines is going to eliminate a certain number of people from participating simply because a lot of people don't have landlines anymore.
That's right. And we even have things called flash polls now, where essentially people go online, even though it's not a sample, and basically vote, and that is used as polling data. And so the whole area of polling essentially has many different methodologies. Obviously, the public at large is not familiar with all of these, and many of these are not very good methodologies.
You know, this is actually probably getting back a little bit more toward our conversation about political correctness. But one of the things that you mentioned to me, again, before the show, is that we're seeing a lot more profanity in this 2016 campaign than we have in the past.
Yes, I think this will be historic in terms of the level of language, or perhaps the low level of language. There's something called the seven dirty words that you can't say on broadcasting.
Which we're not going to say right now.
We're not going to say them. None of the candidates have used them, but they have come close. They maybe have used the eighth or ninth or tenth word. And in particular, I think Donald Trump, and in live events, often will use a profanity or a word that you certainly wouldn't want to use around the dinner table. And in social media language, that's called NSFW, which is not suitable for work. And that's been a very interesting aspect in terms of how people perceive a president, whether they perceive a president as being someone who publicly is going to use that language.
And I remember not that long ago, really, it was either 2000 or 2004 when George W. Bush, when he thought he was off mic, made a profane reference to a reporter. And that was a big deal.
Yeah, the difference is those were stories when they were leaked off of hot mics. Now we actually have the candidates, in particular Donald Trump, saying these words into mics, knowing that these words are going to be broadcast.
Do you think there's a connection between the lack of trust in government, and you don't have to go far to find a poll to show how little we trust our representatives in Washington? Do you think there's a connection between that lack of trust and Americans' perceptions about political correctness? Is there a line to be drawn there?
I don't know. I haven't thought about that. There may be. And I think that, again, is something that the Trump campaign is trying to test by essentially projecting what they believe is politically incorrect rhetoric, and then being able essentially at the same time to say, and here is a candidate, meaning Hillary Clinton, that you should not trust. I think they want to identify political correctness and trust in that candidate, Hillary Clinton, their opponent.
I'm wondering if, again, because we've been talking so much about Donald Trump's campaign and his use of social media, if there's a perception that Hillary Clinton has, at least in that aspect, kind of been left behind or lapped in terms of her social media strategy during this campaign.
I think so. I think if you were basically going to vote for a candidate based on their social media skills and strategy, I think the clear winner here would be Donald Trump. I think he's just done an extraordinary job in how he's not only used the medium but crafted the message to the medium. I think Hillary Clinton has run a much more traditional campaign. And so, again, we will see the results on November 8th in terms of which one is preferable to the voters.
I use this question in regards to Ross Perot, but if, let's say, for instance, that when it comes to the Electoral College, that Donald Trump loses by a long shot. Again, this is all speculation. Will we look back on his strategy and say, well, it got him this far, but it didn't get him all the way to the White House?
Well, it in some respects depends on what plan B is for Donald Trump. There are some rumors now that he intends to actually start a new network, Trump TV, and that would essentially be a perpetual campaign so that Trump TV would essentially be organized to oppose Hillary Clinton for the next 44 years if she's elected.
Last question. We have about 30 more seconds left in the show. In 1960, the Kennedy-Nixon debate, and we referred to that earlier, redefined the ways in which we choose a president. From a strategy standpoint, do you think this 2016 election will be as significant?
No, I don't. And I think what we've seen is a lot of interesting technique, but I think at the end of the day, many of those fundamental issues are the same. Who do you trust in the Oval Office? Who do you trust to have the nuclear codes?
Well, we are regrettably out of time here on Dialogue. I want to thank Stuart Brotman so much for spending some time with us today. Thanks also to Greg Hill, who ran the board and managed the phones today. Big, big, big thanks to Megan Jamerson for helping us with social media and doing a lot of the research for today's show. And thank you for listening and calling and sending your questions. If you missed the show or you just want to hear it again, we should have it up on our webpage in the next hour or so. Just go to WUOT.org. Dialogue is a production of 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville, WUOT HD1 Knoxville, and WUOT.org, a listener-supported service of the University of Tennessee.